My name is Daniel Muinuddin. I'm reading a story titled A Spoiled Man from a collection of short stories titled In Other Rooms, Other Wonders. This story is set in the mountains above Islamabad and concerns the relations between an American woman and a servant who works for her husband's family. She is bored and sort of disaffected living in Pakistan and inadvertently causes him to suffer. A spoiled man. There he stood at the stone gateway of the Haruni's weekend home above Islamabad, a small bow-legged man with a lopsided, battered face. When the American wife's car drove up, turning off the muddy road, Razak saluted, eyes straight ahead, not looking at her. She sat in the back and smiled at him from the milky darkness of the car's interior. What a funny little man. Once he had happened to be walking past as she was driven through the gate, and she had waved. In the few weeks since, he had waited hours to receive this recognition from her, Friday when the family came, Sunday when they left. He had plenty of time. The car continued up the winding flagstone drive and disappeared among the rows of jacaranda trees, blooming purple now in late April. Below lay the roadside town of Kalapani, the bazaar pierced by the horns of buses collecting passengers. Above stood these walls, which enclosed 10 acres of steep land planted with apples, pine, jasmine, roses, and lilies that the wife had brought from America. The wind blew with a rushing sound through the pine branches and combed the fresh green grass sprouting all over the hillside after the winter rains. He made himself useful. In May, pickup trucks full of summered flowers were brought up from the nurseries that surrounded the city on the plains below. When the first trucks arrived, he stood at the gate, watching the gardeners unload the pots, handing them down to each other, and then carrying them up to the house. The loaded vehicle couldn't make it up the steep drive. Without asking, he passed through the gate, which he had never done before, took one of the clay pots in his arms, and walked up with it, rolling slightly in his down-at-heel shoes. "Hey, old man, you better leave that before you hurt yourself," called a gardener, standing in the bed of the pickup. "I'm from the mountains, brother," Razak said. "I can carry you up on my back and one of these in each hand." The pickup driver, who stood to one side smoking a cigarette, grinned. The old majordomo, Gholam Rasul, had strolled down to watch the show, a pot-bellied figure with a tall lambskin hat resting at a slight angle on a fringe of white hair. He sent one of the gardeners up to get his hookah and, comfortably settling himself in the watchman's chair by the gate, looked out over the valley below. At midday, he said to Razak, "Come on then and break bread with us." Razak looked down at his feet. "I'd need to put stones in my gizzard like a chicken to digest the rich food that you good people eat." The majordomo tried to convince him, and the gardeners also pressed, but Razak remained stubborn. "You didn't ask for help. You don't owe me anything." "Suit yourself then," Gholam Rasul said finally. The gardeners walked up the drive talking, and Razak stood watching them, wishing he had accepted. He was alone now. In the distance, he could see a swimming pool with curving sides overhung by chinar trees and willows. Melancholy invaded him, and also peace, borne by the whirring of cicadas nestled among the rocks that punctuated the grounds of the estate. He took a bag from his pocket, undid the elastic band, and tucked a quid of tobacco in his cheek, chopped green naswar. In the Kalapani Bazaar, he ate at his usual tea house, day-old bread soaked in milk, prescribed by a quack homeopath against a fistula that had tormented him for many years. The waiter brought the sopping bread, and when the crowd subsided, he came over to have a few words about the flow of tourists up to Murray, more each year, this season begun so early. Lonely as he was, Razak relied upon his welcome in the tea house, his connection with it. When the older chickens at the poultry sheds where he worked were culled, Razak would bring down one of the healthier birds, asking the tea house to cook it as a holiday from his bread diet. He shared with whoever was there, insistent, forcing his friend the waiter to eat. "There, look, I've taken some," the waiter would say, pulling off a wing. Even he, hardened by a diet of stale leftovers from the kitchen, was dubious about eating this time-expired bird. "No, you have to really eat." Razak even became angry about it once, leaving abruptly, the chicken still on the table. After finishing his lunch, Razak walked through a government pine forest to the poultry sheds. The owner had bribed the wardens to allow construction extending into the forest, and each summer his men set fires at the base of pines planted by the British 100 years earlier in order to kill the trees and open up more space. Reza came to his home, not the workers' quarters attached to the sheds, but a hut that he had built for himself, a little wooden cubicle faced with tin and mounted on thick legs. Several decades before, in his early 20s, he had fallen out with his stepbrothers over shared property up in the mountains, a few acres of land on which they grew wheat and potatoes, bordered by apricot trees. Outmaneuvered, dispossessed, he had come down to the plains, vowing never to see his family again. This box had become his home and consolation. Each place he worked, he set it up, and then, when he quarreled with the other workers or the boss, as he invariably did, he would take it apart and cart it away. Always he kept a store of money, untouched no matter what, enough to pay for trucking this little house, this nest, to whatever place his heart had set on next. This was his guarantee of independence. Opening the heavy padlock, he lifted the door hatch and climbed in, tucking his shoes into a wooden box nailed below the cramped hatch. Run off an electrical connection drawn from the poultry sheds, tiny red lights strung all over the ceiling warmed the chamber. He could sit but not stand inside, and had covered the floor with a cotton mattress, which gave off a ripe animal odor, deeply comforting to him. A funnel and pipe served as a handy spittoon, a mirror and shelf allowed him to shave without getting out of bed, an electric fan cooled him. Photographs of actresses plastered the walls and ceilings, giving him company. Fickle and choosy, he shuffled and moved them, discarding one, stripping the photo from the wall with a cold expression. For several months, he'd been favoring a Pathan actress known as the Atomic Bum, who had wagged her way through a string of hit movies in the past year. A few days later, loitering around the gates of the Haruni estate again, Razak decided to go in, stepping through a narrow entry set into the wall. The owners would be in Islamabad for the week, and earlier he had seen the watchman down in the bazaar. By climbing the slope of the mountain opposite, he had observed the household routine, marked the servants' quarters, watched the owners sitting on a terrace, brightly clothed. Close up, the house seemed to him ugly, made of large, rough-hewn stones, with a vast wall of glass across the front, looking out over the valley and down to Islamabad, 40 kilometers below. Nothing to it, no metalwork, no paint, no decorative lights, plain, only size to recommend it. The house blended into the landscape as if it were one of the boulders littering the mountain slope. He found the majordomo sitting in a chair under a tree, reading a newspaper. "Ah, the volunteer," he said amiably. "Come on then, have a pull on the hookah." Razak sat down on the edge of a charpai, dangling his short legs. "I'm killing myself with this poison instead." He spat and then dipped green coarse tobacco under his gum. "You work up in Ayub's sheds, don't you?" "When Ayub needs me, I work. He pays me in dying chickens and loose change." He tried to make a joke of it. "That's what I hear. Ayub shaves both sides and then trims out the middle piece." Razak laughed mirthlessly. "The way I'm going, soon I'll be eating grass." He paused. "I've been thinking. I can do woodwork. I know about trees. I'll carry things, work in the garden. Feed me and I'll work here and do whatever you want. You don't even have to give me a room. I've got a portable cubicle that I live in. You can stick me in some corner." The owner of the estate, Suhail Haruni, son of a man who made a fortune in cement and other industries, had, while at university in the United States, married an American woman named Sonia. "No, I really love it here," she would say defensively when asked at a party. "It's strange. It's like a drug. I think I miss the state so much. And I do. And then after a month there, I'm completely bored. Pakistan makes everything else seem washed out. This is my place now. I don't do enough, but I feel as if here I can at least do something for the good." She did fit in more than most foreign women. She studied Urdu to the point where she could communicate quite effectively, made an effort to meet Pakistanis outside the circuit in Islamabad. Even her husband's catty aunts admitted that she was one of the few foreigners who wore Pakistani clothes without looking like either an Amazon or a Christmas tree. And yet, though she insisted that she loved Pakistan, sometimes it all became too much. "I hate it. Everyone's a crook. Nothing works here," she would sob, fighting with her husband. Then she would storm out to her car and retreat to the Kalapani house, 40 minutes away, arriving unannounced, withdrawing darkly into the master bedroom while the servants scrambled to prepare her meal. In the evening, she would wander the large stone house, slowly becoming calm, speaking with her friends on the telephone. Her husband would drive up to spend the night with her, bringing their little son as a pledge of their love, and they would make peace. It happened that, soon after Razak made his plea to Ghulam Rasul, Sonia had a huge row with her husband and ran away to Kalapani. The next morning, she sat drinking coffee on the sunny terrace, which had a view out over the government forest, now heavily logged by poachers, and then down to Islamabad and Rawalpindi. The strain of the fight had shaded into a desire for simplicity and order, an almost pleasant tearfulness. Ghulam Rasul came up from the garden, coughing so that she would not be startled. Of all the servants, he was the one she most trusted with her son. She herself felt comfortable with him, with his gentle, stoic manner, with his prayers and his superstitions. Her blonde hair held back by a black velvet band, she wore a simple white blouse, white slacks, and lay on a divan, immaculate, reading a slender volume of poetry. She had been an English major and turned to a handful of familiar books as a restorative, Yeats or Rilke, Keats, to be taken as needed. "Excuse me, Begum Sahib, I wanted to ask, it's time to think about the roses." She knew that he wanted to soften her attitude toward her husband. In any case, she liked him to come and talk with her, and they used as a pretext his supervision of the garden, although he'd always been a valet and knew very little about flowers or trees. She put down her book, and they considered the roses and the placement of the annuals. "Begging your pardon, the local people drive their goats into the Ali Khan orchard, and they're destroying the saplings that you brought from America. There's an old man, he can't do hard labor, but he's a reliable person. His family abandoned him, he even has his own portable hut. He'll take it there and live as a guard. You don't have to give him a salary, just food and a few rupees for pocket money." But she wanted to give the old man the same as all the others. It made her happy to think of spoiling him in his old age. Newly hired, Razak moved to the Ali Khan lands, a walled parcel of 4 or 5 acres, just up the road from the main house. Like the other servants and gardeners, he received a salary of 9,000 rupees a month, more than he had ever made in his life. The gardeners from the big house transported his cubicle in pieces, then helped him reassemble it next to a hut that was already standing there, a single stone-built room with an open hearth, which Razak could use as a storeroom and kitchen. The land had no electric connection, so he bought oil lamps, which glowed soothingly at night as he went about his last chores, his routine of dinner and bedtime. The season turned hot just as Razak moved to his new home, coloring the green fruit on the apple and peach and pear trees imported from America. He devoted all his grateful heart to the little orchard, watering the trees with a bucket from the stream that ran through the property, working manure into the soil with a spade. Taking a bus to Islamabad, with his own money he bought 3 grapevines, carried them back wrapped in straw, and trained them up the legs of his little tin-clad cubicle. He planted radishes, corn, cauliflower, onions, peas, more than he alone could eat, so that as they ripened, he could take baskets of produce up to the big house. With his second paycheck, he bought a goat for milk. Before, in his previous jobs, it would have cost many months' savings. One day, the master and his wife took some guests to the Ali Khan land for a picnic lunch. In the morning, servants brought carpets and divans, tubs full of ice for the wine, grills for the meat, firewood in case the party lasted into the night. Razak spent hours ferrying boxes and chairs and rugs down from the main road to the picnic spot, taking the biggest loads, pushing himself forward, claiming precedence on his plot of land. The guests arrived, Pakistanis and foreigners, a dozen or so of them, and were soon sprawled on the carpets, drinking wine, resolved into several groups. Walking briskly down the path, sure-footed, holding a floppy yellow sun hat with a trailing ribbon in her hand, Sonia had said to Razak as she passed, "Salam, Baba." His heart, his soul melted, as if a queen had spoken to a foot soldier. She had given him charge of the garden, of the trees that she brought from her homeland, and now she was seeing the results of his husbandry for the first time. All the other servants knew what to do. Ghulam Rasul poured the wine and passed the hors d'oeuvres. A cook readied the fire and skewered kebabs on metal rods. The gardeners spread out as a kind of picket to prevent anyone from looking over the walls. Razak's shyness and diffidence contested with a desire to take part, to show off all the work he had done in the orchard. He squatted under an apple tree, trying not to look at the sahibs, pulling up sprigs of grass, tying them into figures and knots, hoping to be summoned. Restless, he knelt down by the cook and took over the job of tending the fire, pushing aside the weedy boy who acted as the cook's helper. Sohail Haroni was a handsome, cheerful man with never a care in his life, who enjoyed giving parties more than anything else. After a few glasses of wine, he called a young valet and told him to bring the stereo from the main house and hook it up. A driver raced to Murray, 10 kilometers up the mountain, and bought a roll of heavy wire. Glasses in hand, the guests and even the host enthusiastically helped string the wire down through the trees from a roadside shop. When the party had come far along, when Haruni and the guests were standing in a circle, drinks in hands, gesturing expansively, speaking loudly, Sonia walked away from the group. Looking along the length of the valley, she caught sight of Razak's cabin, several terraces below the picnic spot. Finding the pathway, she picked her way toward it, and Razak, who had been watching her, quickly followed, leaping down a steep bank so that he could receive her at his little hut, saluting. "It's wonderful," exclaimed Sonia, circling around the cubicle, Razak at her heels. "Hey, everyone," she called to her guests, going over to where she could be heard. "Come see." Short, bow-legged Razak bustled around, showing off the appliances and refinements, the pipe that drained the inside spittoon, the cupboards and drawers set into the outside walls for his tools and clothes and kit, windows that could be propped open or removed entirely, a skylight made of red glass, thick rush matting on the roof to keep the inside cold or hot, with a rubber bladder fixed to the wall that shot water up through a pipe when he squeezed it, wetting the rushes, evaporative cooling. Sonia poked her head inside the stuffy, lurid chamber, considered the photographs of movie starlets plastered on the wall. The guests peered about, inspecting this nest, its door and windows ajar, like a car on a dealer's lot with hood and trunk propped open. "If there's electricity, then it's really something," Razak said, eager, grinning with all his teeth, surrounded by the sahibs and the maim sahibs. "I used to have colored lights inside. There's work to be done, that's true. It's all broken from carrying it up and down and all over." In his exuberance, he pulled at a cupboard door that wouldn't open till it tore off in his hand. Even this didn't dampen him. "See, that's one way to take it apart." "That's the man's whole life in a nutshell, isn't it?" the Australian ambassador, a tall man with a correspondingly tall forehead and ginger hair, remarked. As they were returning to the picnic, Sonia said to her husband, "The poor man should have electricity for a radio and for lighting. He lives all alone here. Imagine how bored he is." "Are you kidding?" Haruni said. "These guys don't get bored." But after the party, the wire that had been laid temporarily so that there would be music remained in place for the next party. Razak strung lights on the outside of the cubicle like wedding decorations and hung a light bulb in the stone hut where he cooked. He bought a radio and finally bought a cheap television, something he had never even thought of wanting. He would lie in his cocoon, soft red lights glowing, the television volume turned up, and drink cup after cup of tea kept hot in a vacuum thermos, a refinement that made him smack his lips with appreciation. Sitting in the Tkalapani tea house one morning, Razak met a young man who lived near his childhood home high in the mountains. "The government pushed the road up to Koti," the man told him. "The bus runs from Kawar. That changed things, you can bet." Hearing of the places he had known all his life made Razak restless. He had left home determined never to go back. Now he wondered what his stepbrothers had told the neighbors about his disappearance. He wanted his family to know of his success. "You and I grew up drinking from the same streams, breathing the same air. You have to accept my hospitality now that we've met. I beg you, come for a cup of tea and then I'll walk you back down here." He took the man by the arm and almost dragged him out of the tea stall. He hurriedly carried a charpai onto the terrace in front of the stone cooking hut, put a pillow on it, ran inside and lit a fire in the hearth, then brought out a table, wiping it with a rag. Luckily, he had a packet of biscuits, and he arranged these on a plate and carried them out with the tea. The man knew of Razak's family, but had little news of them. Forgetting his bitterness and the wrong they had done him, Razak began speaking of his stepbrothers and nephews, of their fertile land, of the well near their fields. "God has been good to me, more than I deserve. I have only one wish, that he had given me sons of my own, as my brothers have." He ran his hands over his face. Razak had not been able to resist boasting of his salary. The man considered for a moment, his eyes alighting on a locked trunk inside the cooking hut that must be full of clothes and who knows what else. He looked at the neat vegetable patch and at the two goats. Razak had bought another when fodder ran low in the forest, and they were cheap. The man had been shown the weird little cubicle furnished with a radio, a television even. "Look, my cousin has a daughter. Something went wrong when she was born, and she's a bit simple. But she can cook and sew and take your goats out to graze. She's quite pretty, even. She's young enough to bear you a son. Her father can barely take care of his other children. Why don't you let me arrange a marriage?" "You're making fun of an old man," replied Razak. But hope and desire pierced his heart when he thought of it. A woman in his house, even one who was not right in the head. And she could bear him a son, and that would be worth anything at all. Now that Razak had money, the boy would go to school. He would learn to read and write and become... Razak could not even imagine what. The son of an old servant at the main house had become a doctor and now continually begged his father to retire and come live with him. Razak would die happy after that. They spoke back and forth all afternoon. In the end, they agreed not only that the girl would be without a dowry, but even that Razak would pay a quite substantial amount of money for her, which the family would take in installments. A few days later, the father delivered the feeble-minded girl. The girl's family had not come, and the two men did not celebrate the marriage, but brought the Maulvi quietly to perform the nikah. When the father left, the girl followed him and cried, until finally they were forced to lock her in the hut. After seeing the father onto the bus, Razak wandered down through the bazaar, stopping to talk for a minute with the man who sold samosas, saying nothing of his marriage, but saving it for himself. He felt more equal now among these people, the shopkeepers, passers-by, families. Someone waited for him also. The house he returned to would not be empty. The poor girl must be frightened, he thought, and turned homeward, stopping to buy a 3-kilo box of sweets, fat yellow laddus, gulab jamun, barfi, shahi tukra. He rattled the chain as he opened the lock so that she wouldn't be startled. She wore makeup, lipstick that had smudged, rouge that made her cheeks almost pink, new clothes made of shiny white cloth. At least that much had been done to celebrate their wedding day. It pleased him that she reached and covered her head with her dupatta, shy before him, her husband. He sat across from her. She kept her eyes cast down. He opened the box of sweets, carefully unknotting the string, took out a laddu and held it out to her on his palm, whispering, "Take this. It's okay. Don't be afraid." He held it there. "Go on." And after a moment, without looking up, she reached out and took it. Gradually, she became accustomed to living with him. He let her roam as she wanted, once he saw that she would not run away. The girl, a tiny thing of 19 or 20, had an impediment and spoke not in sentences, but rather in strings of sound, cooing or repeating words. Her condition was really worse than Razak had expected. But when she settled in, he found that she could more or less cook. He let her sleep in the stone hut until one night, as he was watching television in his cubicle, she cautiously lifted the door flap, stood absorbing the lit red chamber for a moment, and then nimbly leaped in, eyes fixed on the television. After that, she always slept with him. As an adolescent boy, Razak had been married, so long ago that he couldn't remember what his bride had looked like. She had died in childbirth less than a year after the marriage, and the child too had died. Now, after so many years, Razak again had a companion in his home. Life and hope, the flames of individuality that had burned out to nothing, to smoke, again flickered within him. Returning at night from the bazaar with a treat of late-season mangoes or a bit of meat, or stopping work in the orchard at noon to have his midday meal, which the girl warmed and served to him with hot chapatis, he looked forward to her chattering. She had a pretty, almost animal way of watching him while he ate, perched beside him, and after he finished, she brought him a glass of water from the clay pot. In the evening before he came in, she made tea, and when he groaned because of the aching in his legs, she massaged him. Gradually, he found himself able to communicate with her, and more important, she communicated with him, showed happiness when he returned at night, cared for him when he felt ill or sad. She did not, however, bear him a child. Now that his wife cooked for him and pastured the goats, Razak had less to do, especially after the trees lost their leaves and work in the orchard ceased. His wife sat in the dark, smoky hut, cooing to herself. He would often go down to the tea house in Kalapani Bazaar and sit for several hours, watching buses fill and lumber off up the mountain to Kumari or to Kashmir, or race with brakes squealing at the curves down to the cities, honking their horns to call the passengers. He strolled idly through the bazaar, wearing a new woolen vest and carrying a walking stick, or he went to the big house and sat smoking a hookah with Ghulam Rasool. Returning to his hut at dusk after one of these excursions, he found that the fire had burned out in the hearth and his wife was gone. The goats, too, were missing, although she should have brought them in by this time. Sitting in the cold room, he stared at the calendar nailed up on the wall, which showed an elaborate Chinese pagoda. He rubbed his hands together, trying to control his anger. Twice before, when she had disappeared at nightfall, he'd found her far down in the valley, cowering behind some rocks. When he approached her, she grew frightened and covered her face with her hands. At dark, she still had not returned. Rizak took the lantern, lit the tiny flame, and went out, the two goats scrambling in, bleating when he opened the wooden gate that led down into the valley. One of the neighbors called, "Hey, Rizak, can't it wait till morning?" "What can I tell you? My poor old lady's disappeared again." The neighbor sent a little boy to help with the search. Rizak walked all over and called and called. He went home, hoping that she would be there waiting for him, but he saw no glimmer of light in the cooking hut. As he sat in the cold, the sound of twigs breaking as he laid the fire seemed particularly loud. The fire caught, crackling, slowly warming the room. Mechanically, he threw a handful of tea in the kettle, boiled the water, mechanically poured it into the cup. He didn't have it in him to be angry now. Without eating dinner, without turning on the television, as he did every night, he lay alone in the dark cabin, wondering what could have become of her. What if she was lying hurt somewhere in the forest? In the morning, he woke before first light, hurriedly dressed, and went out. He didn't know where to look, which direction to turn. Living alone for years, he'd learned not to ask for help. Neighbors would do whatever they could once or twice or five times, but ultimately they would grow cold and resentful. He walked along the paths that she might have taken, then deep into the woods to the places where she cut grass. Once he saw a cloth that he thought might be her shawl, but coming close, he saw that it had been rained on and must have been lying there for days. Finally, he went to ask the Haruni retainers for help. Going into the servants' common room, he found Ghulam Rasool lying peacefully on a charpai, his unlit hookah beside him. The fireplace chimney had backed up, as it always did, filling the low-ceilinged room with layers of acrid pine smoke. As Rizak walked into this familiar room, he broke down for the first time. His arms hung loosely as he shuffled up to the bed and stood with his face contorted. "My wife disappeared," he blurted out before he'd even said salam. "I can't find her anywhere. She's gone." Flat tears slipped out of his gummy eyes and disappeared into the wrinkles of his face. Remembering himself, he reached down and shook Ghulam Rasool's hand respectfully. "What do you mean, disappeared?" asked Ghulam Rasool, startled. Squeezing Rizak's arm to make him sit on the charpai, he called out through the door, "Hey, one of you boys, come here." Four gardeners answered the summons, and after asking a few questions, ignored Rizak. They huddled together and made their plan, eager as a pack of hounds, then headed out, their wooden staffs tapping quickly as they walked off on separate paths. Late at night, they straggled back one by one, having found no trace of the woman. In the morning early, they went out again, determined to find her. They searched the mountains, the furthest terraced fields, went to the nearby villages. The next day, again they searched from dawn to dusk, and then the next, but with less and less determination. One of them asked at every bus stop from Murray down to Rawalpindi. Another went all the way to the girl's family home up the mountains, almost in Kashmir, but they had seen nothing of her. In any case, she couldn't possibly have made the long journey alone. Finally, only Rizak kept searching. He forgot even where he had already been, returning to the same places, as if this time he might find her there. One morning, getting ready to go out and continue the search, he sat down again, took off his coat, and lay down on the bed. Imbecile, chattering, but she was gone, dead or stolen, taken to the brothels of Pindi or Karachi. He prepared himself to bear the loneliness again. Every year at Christmas, the Harunis gave a big party at Kalapani with roast goose, a 20-foot tree in the entrance hall of the house, and a ho-hoing Santa Claus for the children. Trucks brought logs for a bonfire from the Harunis' farm down on the plains so that late at night the servants could grill spicy, greasy kebabs on the coals for the heavy drinkers and mull cauldrons of spiced punch for the rest. The guests came up from Islamabad, singly or in long chains of cars, blowing in through the door with wrapped presents and bottles of wine and champagne, which Ghulam Rasool placed on a long table standing in the hall. Before dinner, the mistress came into the kitchen. The cook stood rubbing his hands on his apron, sidelined in his own domain, as she took a big bowl under her arm and poked with a spatula at the mashed potatoes, which the cook had already beaten to a creamy smoothness. Ghulam Rasool had been following her impassively as she performed her inspection. "Excuse me, Begum Sahib, may I trouble you with a small request?" "Of course," she said, touching him lightly on the shoulder. He had become accustomed to this, although at first it had disturbed him. Briefly, he explained about the disappearance of Razak's wife. "But Ghulam Rasool, you should have told me right away. What can I do?" Ghulam Rasool had an encyclopedic knowledge of his master's friends, their power, their wealth, and he took great pride in these connections. When he saw Umar Bukhari, the son of the Inspector General of Police, arrive at the party, he had sent a gardener to fetch Razak and told him to wait in the kitchen. If Bukhari Sahib would speak to the police in Murray, she went into the living room and found Bukhari looming over a French girl who would come with someone else, insisting that she must let him arrange a trip into the tribal areas of the frontier, which were off-limit to foreigners. "Really, Delphine, you should go. It's amazing, and you'll never have the chance otherwise," said the hostess. "Umar, can I pull you away for a moment?" Bukhari followed her to the candlelit dining room.
"So, Ghulam Rasool Sahib, what's going on?"
The Haruni friends all knew Ghulam Rasool and joked that he had more power than many federal ministers. Ghulam Rasool explained, emphasizing the girl's attractiveness to make it seem like an abduction by one of the gangs who kidnap or buy women for prostitution, a scenario in which the police could help, since these things generally happened under their protection and they received a cut of the take.
"We'll break the bastards' legs when we catch them," said Bukhari, who had been drinking quite heavily. "Go fetch the husband."
Razak came in, trembling, and couldn't explain himself, but stood with a grief-stricken face, expectant, as if his wife might there and then materialize through the power of this important sahib. Bukhari had dealt with many cases of missing women, and knew that the family was almost always involved. He fixed Razak with a hard gaze. "Who took her? The father? Did the family take her back?" "Only God above in his mercy knows, sir. I came home one night and she had gone. I couldn't find her, sir. I'm an old man. I'm nothing." Recalling the presence of his hostess, Bukhari relented. Flipping open his tiny cell phone, he punched a number. "Get me the DSP Murray." After a moment, a voice came on the line. "Hello, Kazmi. How are you? This is Umar Bukhari." "Yes, everything's fine. I'm in Kalapani at the house of Mr. Sohail Haruni. The wife of one of his servants has been abducted. I want her back by tomorrow night." "Yes? No, no. Come to the house in the morning and take down the details. I want you personally to handle this." Without saying goodbye, he snapped shut the phone. He smiled at Sonia. Done. Razak, who understood none of the conversation, which had been conducted in English, crouched and touched Bukhari's knee with both hands, began to speak, and then fell silent, bowing his head. Ghulam Rasool raised him up by the arm and led him away. In the morning, the deputy superintendent of police himself showed up at the house in his official jeep, flying a police flag, and accompanied by a pickup full of policemen carrying beat-up rifles. Unfortunately, the Harunis and all the guests had already left for Islamabad. The DSP sat on a chair placed in the middle of the hall with a quivering staff lined up in front of him.
"Where's the husband?"
Ghulam Rasool, the only one not perturbed by this policeman with stars on his shoulders, explained that Razak lived at another property down the road.
"Get him."
Razak came in, breathless, led by a policeman.
"So, old man," the DSP stated, "they tell me your wife has run away."
He began asking questions in a low voice. Though at first he spoke gently, his tone soon became irritated.
"What you're saying is her parents sold her to you. Where did you get that much money?"
Ghulam Rasool stepped forward. "Sir, she's not well in the head. This man took her from kindness as much as anything. And then our sahib is very good to us. He gives us everything we need and more. Women don't just fly away on their own. Either this man knows something about it or she's in Karachi by now. The best thing is for him to be quiet." The DSP looked intently at Razak for a moment, clasping his hands on his stomach. Then stood up.
Please give my regards to Haruni Sahib, he said to Ghulam Rasool, speaking politely and almost formally. I am always at his service. He begged off taking a cup of tea, claiming that he had an appointment. Watching the policeman and his escort drive off, Ghulam Rasool said to Razak, better stay out of the bazaar for a couple of days. He seemed like a pretty rude character. Just after dusk, four policemen in an unmarked car picked up Razak from his orchard and took him to the police post at Threat, 20 kilometers down the road. Did you find her? He'd asked when they came to his cubicle. The youngest policeman, the only one in uniform, said, yes, yes, don't worry. But he grabbed Razak by the shoulder, took his arms and handcuffed him. Razak said nothing more and allowed them to do as they liked. Only when they put him in the back of the car did Razak ask, but what have I done? Where are you taking me? Shut up, Baba, said the policeman, who had up till then been quite gentle. They walked him into a windowless room in the police station and hung him up on a hook by the manacles around his wrists so that his feet touched the ground only when he stood on his toes. He hung on the wall all evening, long past the time when it seemed possible that the excruciating pain in his shoulders and back could be borne. In the next room, policemen came and went, but he was no longer aware of them. At one point, a policeman who had just come in from outside asked, who's he? No idea. The DSP's guy sent him in. Strip, polish, and paint, I suppose. Ah, said the newcomer. He went out singing, the night is made for lovers. After midnight, a large man wearing civilian clothes came into the room. Two uniformed policemen came behind him and shut the door. All right, let's see, said the big man. So what's your name, old man? Muhammad Razak, sir. He began weeping and blubbering. I beg you, I've done nothing. I'm innocent. Now you've hung me up here. I beg you, remember, there's a God above who judges everything. The large man became suddenly angry. I see, he said menacingly, gritting his teeth. I'm the one who's being judged. It's my fault, is it? I'm the one who's guilty. He slapped Razak with all his strength. Where's your wife, you bastard? I know all about it. Nobody took her. You sold her down the road, you pimp. And now you'll tell me who to and when and for how much. He walked to the opposite wall and back, then came up and looked closely into Razak's face. Or perhaps you killed her. She didn't have children. You bought a lemon. Ready for a new one, money bags? He slapped Razak again, cutting his lip. You listen to me. I can make you fuck your own daughter if I want to. You'll hump her all night like a dog fucking a bitch. For God's sake, for God's mercy, I don't have a daughter, sir. You're really trying to piss me off, aren't you? And then to one of the men, take him down. The two uniformed policemen lifted Razak off the hook and threw him to the ground. Rubbing his hands together, the big man looked down at Razak appraisingly, as if considering his next move. Stretch him out and bring me the strap. They pulled down his shalwar, carried him to a bench and stretched him on it, one pulling his arms and one pulling his feet. They had removed his kurta when they hung him up on the wall. The big man brandished what looked like the sole of an enormous shoe, with writing on one side in thick black script. See what this says? It says, sweetheart, where did you sleep last night? Understand? Without warning, he swung. Razak shrieked, a startled high-pitched sound. He never had felt pain like this, which spread flickering all through his body. Another policeman came into the room when Razak screamed and stood by the door, watching, with a grin on his face. Come here, said the big man. You do it since you're so interested. You need the practice anyway. Of course he could tell them nothing. I don't know, he sobbed. She's gone. I don't know anything. After a few strokes, he fell into a rhythm, shrieking when they hit him, then when they stopped, groaning, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. After beating Razak for 5 or 6 minutes, they threw him into a storeroom. The DSP stopped at the Threat post on his way down to Islamabad from Murray. The big man stood up and casually saluted when the officer walked in. They shook hands. What's going on? Anything new? Called from Awaz Khan, Sahib. He keeps asking why we haven't picked up those two clowns from Mariani. They discussed this. Something to do with a road contractor. Villagers blocking the line of a new road. They needed to be shown the stick. As he started to leave, the DSP asked, what about that missing girl? Someone driving by must have seen her and snatched her. The Chandias say they didn't do it. Only the Chandias, the most powerful of the gangster clans in the area, would have presumed to abduct a woman without cutting in the police. And we pulled in the husband and worked on him. He's clean. The DSP made a face. You didn't. This is some American woman's pet servant. Tell me you didn't do anything severe. He's fine, he's fine. Do you want to see him? No. You're positive, right? I'm definitely positive. No marks? Well, sir, no visible marks. I have to work somewhere. The DSP laughed. I suppose you do. After thinking for a moment, he said, I'll have to go see Bukhari Sahib and explain that she's disappeared off the face of the earth. It's a good idea to put in an appearance there anyway. What about the old man? Dump him at home and tell him he better keep his mouth shut. Shortly before dawn, almost tenderly now, they bundled Razak into the same unmarked car and sneaked him back into his hut. You've tasted it once. Don't make us dose you again. Not a word to anyone. Do you understand? Razak stared at his feet. Finally, he nodded his head. He lay all that day without sleeping, into the dusk, then the dark. His buttocks had swollen up, puffy and white, like bread dough, so that he had to lie on his stomach. His mind whirled without touching on any one thing for more than a moment. The wife he married when almost still a boy, who died so many years ago. Then his second wife, the little mentally disturbed girl. His stepbrothers, who took his land, the fruit trees in the garden there in Kashmir, and the fruit trees here, brought from America. His things, his television, the day he went to the store and bought the bright red plastic television. Why should I complain? The police did to me as they always do. The fault is mine, who married in old age with one foot in the grave. God gave me so much more than I deserved when I expected nothing at all. He made sure to be perfectly silent about what had happened. After he recovered, he was left with one last wish. In Razak's mind, good fortune and grace were wound together, so that the Haruni family's connections and wealth established not simply the power of the household, but also its virtue. Ghulam Rasul had served the Harunis for more than 50 years. Some of the other retainers had served almost as long. He could never equal that service. But nevertheless, the family took him in when otherwise he might have begged in the streets. They gave him the money to live beyond his station. They made him hope for too much. And when he lost the girl, their instruments punished him for having dared to reach so high, for owning something that would excite envy, that placed him in the way of beatings and the police. Now he belonged to the Harunis. This was how he understood justice. He said to Ghulam Rasul, I beg you, ask our master to bury me here on this land, in one corner, whichever one he likes. This became his dream and his consolation. He lived on for another year, then 6 months more, collecting his salary, never spending a rupee more than was sufficient to keep his body warm. He sold the television, sold the goats. At the end of 18 months, he went up to Murray, to the stonecutter, and said that he wanted the very best gravestone in the shop and carved marble to sheathe the rest of the grave. After his night in the police station, Razak walked gingerly and made grunting noises under his breath. Everyone remarked on how he'd changed after his wife disappeared. The stonecutter, seeing this bent, trembling figure, thought, "This old bird doesn't know what good marble costs." But Razak took out a roll of bills tied in a greasy handkerchief that he pulled from under his shirt. Blue notes, thousands. Well, that's different, said the stonecutter, taking Razak's hand and leading him into the back room. Look at this piece now. Look at the color, the grain. Look at the size of that. I swear to God, I've been saving it for my own mother. No one had seen the old man for several days, and the gardener sent to inquire rattled and knocked and then found him dead in the little cubicle. Ghulam Rasul had the gardeners dig a grave along the wall of the property, and that evening they buried him, just a few people attending the janaza, the servants from the big house, a few men from the bazaar and from houses on the hillside next to the Ali Khan lands. A poor man from nearby had been paid to wash the body. The Maulvi from the mosque in the bazaar said the prayer. The next Friday, Sonia came up from Islamabad at nightfall, bringing just her young son and his ayah. Ghulam Rasul, dropping a pill of sweetener into a cup of tea, said, I beg your pardon, madam. The old man Razak, whom you so kindly put in charge at the Ali Khan lands, has passed away. The electricity had failed, as it often did up on the mountain. At dusk, by candlelight, the tall rooms of the stone-built house were solemn and chilled, like an empty church or a school when the children are gone. Poor, poor thing, all alone, and his wife disappeared. At moments, as now, she felt closer to Ghulam Rasul than to anyone else in Pakistan. His large, dark, compassionate face, heavy body, his shrewd and yet ponderous manner, his orthodox, unshakable beliefs. He was silent for a moment, then continued, Please forgive me, but I took the liberty of having him buried in the Ali Khan orchard. He had asked me to speak with you. still not touching her tea, looking up at him as he stood with his hands crossed on his belly, she said gently, "I'm so glad that you did, Ghulam Rasool. Of course Mia Sahib and I would want that." The old servant had come far by knowing the ways of his masters. Saying no more nor less than this, he withdrew quietly, leaving Sonia musing by the fire on having done the right thing for a lonely old man, having done a little bit for the good. The next morning, slipping out of the house, Sonia took Ghulam Rasool and a single gardener and walked up to the Ali Khan lands. The smallness of the grave surprised her, the mound decorated with tinsel in advance of her visit, the marble stones he had bought stacked beside it. Ghulam Rasool and the gardener said the Fatiha, holding their upturned palms in front of them and silently reciting a prayer, and Sonia stood also with her hands upturned and eyes closed, thinking first of the old man, a life drawn to a close with so little fanfare, and then of her own dead, her father and mother lying under the snow in Wisconsin graveyard. When they had finished, she walked around the garden, looking at the fruit trees, the leaves colored and falling as the autumn season advanced. "What would you have us do with this?" asked Ghulam Rasool, leading her to the cabin, which sprouted a television antenna and bouquets of crude plastic flowers, their petals thick as tongues, bought by Razak soon after his marriage, nailed up along the roof one day to please his wife's innocent heart. The old man didn't want his family to have anything from him. It seemed to her vividly alive, a motionless hirsute presence, the antenna, the flowers, the four massive legs, the pipe that drained the inside spittoon, trailing into the grass as if drawing nourishment. She told them to bring it up to the big estate and park it in a shaded corner, somewhere not too visible, as a memorial. Her husband, a raconteur, could show it to his guests and tell them about Razak, the old man who entered service bringing his own house. At first, the cabin sat inviolate below the swimming pool, locked, Razak's things still in the cupboards and drawers. Sonia went once to look at it, then not again, her attention fading. Gradually, like falling leaves, the locks were broken off, one person taking the thermos, another the wood tools, files and a hammer, a plane, a level. The clothes disappeared, the last cupboard emptied, even the filthy mattress pulled out and put to use, taken by the sweeper who cleaned the toilets in the big house. The door of the little cabin hung open. The wind and blown rain scoured it clean.